Hello and welcome to News 24 on Air, our live audio service. I'm Karen Morn and I have the incredible pleasure of being joined by Dan Mafora, whose brilliant book, Capture in the Court, in Defense of Judges and the Constitution, I have read, and it really is one of the most must-read books of the year for so many different reasons. But I wanted to start by with you, Dan, just asking you that it's very clear that misinformation is a big concern for you and that there has been the sustained campaign of misinformation about our courts, about our judiciary, about the Constitution, about rule of law itself that has been pushed by a number of very senior politicians but has become extremely prevalent on social media. And for me, this book is literally a chapter and verse response to a lot of those critiques. In your mind, why was it important to actually confront that misinformation, which a lot of people just go, oh, whatever, those people will say whatever, and actually attack it head on with in the way that you have?
So the initial reason for that was because I thought being dismissive was not helping anyone. Mm. And I was seeing the kind of damage that this misinformation was doing. And so I thought it's serious enough to undermine the legitimacy of our legal system, undermine confidence in judges, and the kind of dismissive responses that were being put out were not changing anyone's mind. They were not making things better. They were not acting in defense of judges and the Constitution, because it's taken for granted that people believe that judges are fair, that judges do their job impartially and independently. But obviously a large section of the public doesn't, because of what they've been fed. And I thought it was very important for a voice to come in and kind of take those claims seriously and respond.
Now, you've very much looked at populism as a political concept and said that a lot of the, or pretty much all of the attacks that are being leveled against the Constitution, this kind of weird nostalgia for a parliamentary sovereignty system that was used by the apartheid government to put Robert Sobukwe behind bars for 6 years when he was sentenced to three, that this is, you know, this is the roots of this kind of misinformation. Why do you think populism is so fixated on attacking the legitimacy of our judicial system?
So what I found as I was doing research and I was reading up on populism, what struck me was how the claim, the populist claim, is motivated by a complete, this hunger for complete and totalizing power that is not constrained by any kind of standard, any kind of law, any kind of rule. And so the undermining of the Constitution, the undermining of the courts functions to delegitimize them, to make sure that they are seen as a negative thing, right? So the idea that power needs to be constrained in some way is painted as a denial of democracy. So when people say, majority rules, they're not saying that in the normal way that we understand that if you are in government and you need to take a decision, you do so by majority vote. What they're saying is, once I have a majority, then I can do whatever I want.
Exactly.
And so because the Constitution acts as this constraint and judges enforce the Constitution, it becomes important to attack, weaken, delegitimize those two institutions and make sure that when you then get to the point where you make it quite explicit that what you want is unregulated or unconstrained power, it is seen as acceptable because the Constitution and judges are already seen in a negative light. And so that's the kind of the kind of work that the populist appeal does.
What I love about this book is that you really remind us of what could have happened in certain incredibly painful circumstances, like the provision of ARVs to pregnant women, HIV-positive pregnant women, if the courts had not intervened and not said to the Mbeki administration, listen, you have to provide these drugs. You know, the kind of impact that would have. The Grootboom case, which is about the provision of housing, and in bringing and Michael Komape's matter, of course, as well, this child who drowns in his own feces in a pit latrine, all of which circumstances where the courts have intervened to protect and uphold the Constitution and the constitutional value that we, you know, human beings, all human beings, regarded of their resources, are entitled to certain rights. But yet simultaneously, we see these kind of populist politicians employing a language that says, oh, well, the courts are anti-poor.
Right, right.
The courts are, you know, they're stopping us from providing proper services.
Mm.
And I think what's, you know, I think that's almost staggering when one compares what the courts have actually done to protect the rights of the poor.
Absolutely. So it's quite interesting that on the one hand, the courts are said, you know, to be an obstacle. They're not allowing us to exercise our political power to achieve specific goals. But when the courts do step in and say, actually, under the Constitution, you have these particular duties to provide healthcare, housing, water, that is also seen as a negative thing, because then you're overstepping your power as a judge. You are not elected. This is, you know, you have no right to tell us basically how to spend public funds. But those obligations are there. And so there is this tension where on the basis of facts and history as we know it, it's not true that judges are anti-poor or courts are anti-poor or whatever. Judges have been instrumental in, as you point out, ensuring that, you know, textbooks are delivered, that there's children are being fed in schools, that there's a housing policy, that there is social security, right?
People get grants.
Get grants. And this idea that it's just a fanciful idea that exists somewhere in an alternate reality. But again, the point is this idea that people just want political power for its sake and do not want to be held to any standard. And so it was important for me to also say, you know, the Constitution isn't just about constraining power. It's also about laying out a framework of democratic governance. And as you said, we accept at a base level that everyone should have at least these very few basic rights.
One of the interesting points for me is that I think there's a fundamental, in my view, political immaturity to individuals who immediately attack the courts and with blunt force trauma criticism.
Mm.
Because as you rightly point out, and you do it very brilliantly, you compare a judgment that was given against Zuma with a judgment that was given against Ramaphosa, and you say, listen, I do have certain difficulties in the application of the law, and you give this very nuanced, important critique. But that's not what happens. We have, oh, the courts are captured. Oh,
right, right.
The courts are with Ramaphosa. Mm. And you bring up all this stuff. That's why it's such a kind of current, conversational, very, very interesting book. But it's so interesting to me that you get the same language of bashing the courts, undermining judges, saying that, you know, that they don't know what they're doing, that they're jealous of me, quote unquote, Busisiwe Mkhwebane, coming from people like, you know, the former president Jacob Zuma, the EFF laureate Julius Malema, Busisiwe Mkhwebane, Lindiwe Sisulu, and then on the other side of the world, someone like Donald Trump.
Mm.
And, you know, there's this massive differentiation in political ideology, but the populism is the same. And globally, that's happening all over the world. And there does seem to be, even in Israel, you know, prior to the current conflict that we're seeing, this fierce attack on judges. And we're not isolated in that at all.
Absolutely. It's absolutely a global movement. I mean, as far back as 2016, I think Latin America and South America and Brazil, later in Eastern Europe, Poland, Hungary. Poland, I think, seems to be turning, a tide. But Hungary had complete populist takeover, rewritten the constitution, took away the constitutional court's powers, and basically has made sure, Viktor Orban has made sure that any other government that comes will not be able to undo the damage that he's done, or the institutionalization and constitutionalization of populism there. And I think the same almost happened right in America. And there was that erosion of democratic norms where the things that used to be agreed among the political elites as conventions that make democracy work, Trump completely appended that. And we are seeing that kind of erosion of norms coming in to, for example, the JSE process, right?
Absolutely.
An absolutely fundamental process, an absolutely fundamental institution. But also we saw with the public protector how that office was hijacked and put for use for partisan ends. And that's the danger of populism, as I point out, isn't actually electoral, because they don't think that they know that they're not going to get enough power to actually win an election outright. So they take over the institutions of government and they turn them around and put them in service of these particular ends that are anti-democratic and that are focused on the amassing of political power for themselves.
I think it's so important that you bring up the Judicial Service Commission, because as you very brilliantly track in the book, it has become this, you know, very damaging site for the judiciary, because we've had two scenarios, the first of which I want to get into, where you see judges who've given rulings in politically loaded matters, whatever they may be, actively having their careers stopped or blocked. So you give the example of Aubrey Ledwaba with the CR17 records, and you examine the mythology that surrounds that versus the reality. And, you know, also, as we well know, Judge Elias Machajani getting death threats, as the JPM Lambo brought up during his Chief Justice thing. But do you think that there is a very damaging message being sent to judges that if you take on these cases and you rule against the interests of particularly politically powerful individuals, it's career inhibiting for you?
Right. Absolutely. You're completely right. And it's concerning that, you know, for a long time there wasn't a pushback in the JSE itself against the kind of questioning that we saw, at least, you know, in its most egregious forms in 2021 and 2022, where there is an outright campaign, as you can see, to delegitimize very good candidates simply because of the decisions that they've given. And I mean, that's an erosion of the idea of the independence of the judiciary, because first of all, judges shouldn't have to account for the decisions that they've made. All of the reasons that for their decisions are in the judgments, right? And that's the final word. And so this culture at the JSE of subjecting candidates who do their work as they're supposed to very spurious attacks, very unethical and just downright unprofessional conduct, is a threat to judicial independence on the one hand because people are stopped from progressing, but on the other hand, we have to look at who gets appointed eventually, right?
Yeah.
And what that implies for the future of judicial independence.
Now, I know that you have an amazing relationship with the incredible Justice Mbuyiseli Madlanga. Mm. And he, of course, gave an incredibly important judgment in regards to the JSC and the need for transparency about deliberations, if I'm remembering correctly. And my argument is somewhat different, because we tend to emphasize this issue of, okay, well, let's look at the composition, let's look at constitutional amendments so that there's less so-called political figures within the JSC, which is going to be a long and convoluted process. My argument is, given the Madlanga principles that are espoused in that judgment, should we not have an open deliberation process, and should the voting process not be open? Because these people are not embarking on a process that should be secret. And I, you know, it's as you well know, when the CASAC litigation came in regards to challenging, you know, the that one round of constitutional court, you know, in, I think it was in 2021. The deliberations that came out of that were truly disturbing, because you had the Chief Justice at the time, Mogoeng Mogoeng, literally come out and say, I've got this list, let's appoint these guys. It was no discussion. So do you think that having an open and transparent process, because of the abuses that and the clear politicization that's happening, and political parties being asked to account by their voters for why did you choose that particular candidate. Do you think that could go somewhere to it, or is it just off the table?
No, I think you're completely right that in that HSF judgment, of course, it was quite limited to whether or not, you know, you were entitled to the deliberations after the fact.
Yes.
But I think that you're right that transparency would actually go a long way for us to see what happens behind closed doors and to see the reasoning, right? Because the JSC may be, I don't know, able to distill reasons after having thought about it, but actually seeing it in action would, I think, do a great deal for confidence in the judiciary. And I think that you're completely right that there's no reason for them to be secret, because the interviews are not secret.
No.
So why should it be? And I mean, the most humiliating things probably happen in the interview to the candidates. And so I think on principle, you're completely right that they should be open and should be transparent, and we should have access and be able to hold our political representatives accountable.
It did seem at the last JSC interviews, just certainly on the first day, that there was a return to a kind of, you know, the, I mean, CASAC has been one of the organizations, Helen Sussman Foundation, pushing for what are the requirements for judicial appointment? What are the criteria? How are those interviews managed? And it did seem that that criteria issue was going to have an impact. And then, of course, we saw what we saw with, you know, David Unterhalter and Tina Siowendu, who were both extremely strong candidates. Also John Smith, I think, being completely sidelined. And, of course, you know, two other judges, Judge Kathy Sitlawane, and then quite a surprise candidate, you know, being put, Judge Malashane, being put forward. So, you know, it's very clear that there's a tug of war in that organization, and it speaks straight to what the heart of what your book is saying, which is really, this isn't something that's just about this kind of fringe on Twitter attacking judges. This is a full-scale, very concerted political project that is about undermining what was and should be one of the most the functional arm of state, you know, many, many decades before. Mm. And, you know, that was one of the things that I think comes away from this, is once you read this book in its entirety, it paints a very, very disturbing picture.
So you're right that it's not a fringe. And when I started writing the book, I was like, maybe I'm concerning myself with, like, you know, things that are remote. But as I went through and I was reading and I was watching the JSC interviews, and I really did get, like, really bleak about the state of our judiciary and what is likely to happen in the future. But what I can say is that the issue of the criteria was the first, was a huge success for accountability, because now they have the criteria and they can say they're adhering to it. But now we have to test that. And that's why we've, CASAC has written to the JSC to say, well, you need to give us reasons, one, why you chose those two particular candidates, but also why you didn't choose the other eight candidates when you measure them against the criteria that you've adopted and the criteria in the constitution as well. So we'll be able to see and test that out and see if they're just paying lip service because, you know, they want to placate us or whatever. But certainly I think that there is and you know, I'm just going to mention this in passing, but the recent claim by Pabasa that, you know, they deserve representation on the JSC is also quite telling at the point that it comes, given the changes that have happened over the past couple of years and the people leading that this new campaign. And so I think it is something that we should take seriously and not look at these JSC interviews as isolated incidents, but to cumulatively track the influence that they've had on the process over the last couple of years.
So, I mean, obviously, you know, that in this book, there's really no holds barred. I mean, it's obviously an profound interrogation of South Africa's legal history, where the constitution comes from. And there's a lot of, like, really beautiful, you know, exposition on political history and the character of the ANC and why the ANC has its attitude towards the law. And it's very, very valuable. But you also don't shy away from mentioning people or specifically addressing the rhetoric of, for example, someone like former President Jacob Zuma, Julius Malema's conduct in the JSC, Busisiwe Mkhwebane's, what did you describe it as?
I think pseudo-martyrdom.
Yes.
Pseudo-martyrdom, yeah.
Pseudo-martyrdom. I used that in a quote yesterday. I should have remembered it. And also Lindiwe Sisulu, who embarked on this rhetoric, in regards to this harking back to parliamentary sovereignty, which of course is what we know the apartheid system used so successfully to unlawfully violate the rights of a black majority. You must know that if any of these people, per chance, or their supporters read this book, you're probably going to get a deluge, an absolute deluge of abuse. But you did it anyway. Like, what informed that decision-making process? And was there any part of you that was like, you know what, maybe I must just write a book about something else, you know?
Look, I think I had an opportunity to do something, right? To be, and also be true. Like, I'm not writing a puff piece for judges. I'm not writing a puff piece for the Constitution. These are my thoughts, and I've thought about it long enough, and I think it's quite important to be frank with each other. And, you know, some of the people I mentioned in the book taught me at university. They're very good friends of mine. And they know that this is what I think, and I've put it out there. And certainly, if people feel strongly, then, yeah, they should engage. And that's the point of a book anyway. It's supposed to open up engagement, and I hope if it provokes people, it does so in the right way.
Thank you so much, Dan Mafora. I would urge anyone, actually everyone, whether you're a legal person or you're not a legal person, get this book. It is phenomenally well written. It's just an absolutely brilliant read, and it's an important read because it goes to the heart of the struggle for our democracy, for rule of law, for the Constitution in this particularly fraught time. And you need to be informed about it because this particular issue will shape the future of this country. Thank you, Dan Mafora.
Thank you so much.